Welcome to Simoncast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. I'm John Shaw, the director of the Institute. In Simoncast, we aim to keep the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well through wide-ranging civil conversations. And today, we're really delighted to be joined by Brian Rosenberg, who has had a remarkable career as a college president, and as a scholar and as a writer, and has some really interesting perspectives. Let me tell you a little bit about Brian. He is a New Yorker, grew up on Long Island, went to undergrad at Cornell University, and then has master's and doctorates from Columbia, has had this really stellar career. He was an English professor, starting out at Allegheny College, became the dean of faculty at Lawrence University, and was president of McAllister College for 17 years, from 2003 to 2020, a really, really long time for a college president, as you know. He's gone on to do some interesting things. He has been a president in residence at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, works with us, sits on some boards, and also does some really important work with a new university in Africa called the Africa Leadership University, which we want to hear a lot about. And he is also the author of a terrific book called Whatever It Is, I'm Against It, Resistance to Change in Higher Education, a really interesting, provocative book that challenges a lot of the conventional wisdom in higher education. And so, has some really important and interesting insights. So Brian joins us today from his home and office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, outside of Boston, and we're delighted to have him here. So good morning, Brian.
Morning, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Well, let's talk a little bit about your background. I mean, you know, as I said, you grew up on Long Island. Were you always, you know, sort of a reader as a kid? Was the academic path the one that you seemed destined for?
Well, if you asked my mother, she would have said medical school. But if you asked me, I probably always would have said something related to literature. I enrolled in college with the intention of being a biology major, quickly changed my mind. And then from really my first year in college, I knew after taking a few literature courses that that's what I wanted to devote my life to. So I was on this path pretty early. And from the moment I entered Cornell in 1973 until now, I've really never left the world of higher education.
Right. And then I kind of skipped over it. I mean, your expertise is Victorian literature with a particular interest in an expertise in Charles Dickens. Did that also, that your fascination with Dickens begin at a relatively young age?
No. Actually, I hated reading Great Expectations in high school. And my appreciation for Dickens grew when I was an undergraduate. And I think you need to be old enough to appreciate the nuances of some of those novels. And so it was not something that came to me at a very early age. I was more likely to be reading science fiction when I was in high school than Little Dorrit.
Well, and then in terms of we could spend a whole time talking about your academic trajectory, but, you know, you started out as an English professor, and then you moved into administration. I know in the book you're somewhat self-deprecating about saying you, as a young professor, you had lots of opinions on administration and would offer them rather forcefully and so forth. But, I mean, so how did the transition from just pure from teaching to administration occur? Was it, did you just get the sense that, you know, that this is something I can do well and it's interesting?
I was one of those unusual faculty members who actually liked serving on committees. I found the way the entire institution operated to be extraordinarily interesting. So I liked serving on committees that dealt with finance, that dealt with admissions, that dealt with student life. And after a certain time, I was 27 when I got my first tenure track position. I did that for 15 years. And I asked myself whether I wanted to do the same thing for the next 25 or 30, or whether I wanted to do something that was a little bit different. And when the opportunity to be a dean at Lawrence came along, I sort of ran out of reasons not to do it. And once I started down that path, it confirmed the sense that looking at the whole institution was to me really, really interesting. I missed the classroom, and I missed the immediate jolt you get from teaching a really good class. But I kept telling myself that I was trying to create the conditions that would allow other students and other faculty members to learn. So the rewards might be less indirect, might be more indirect, but I found them to be considerable. So once I was on that path, I really sort of never looked back.
The jump to a presidency at McAllister, I mean, is that a kind of a quantum leap into the world of, we'll talk about the college presidencies in a second, but was that a kind of a quantum jump into the world of complexity and juggling various constituencies? I mean, talk about that transition from dean to president.
You know, I was fortunate when I was at Lawrence to be mentored by then President Rick Warch, who had been there a long time. He gave me a lot of exposure to a lot of areas of the institution that maybe some deans don't get. So that helped. But the reality is, there's nothing that can fully prepare you for the move into a college presidency if you've never done it before. What was most difficult, challenging for me to adjust to was the 24/7 visibility. The fact that even when you left the campus, and even in a city that is sizable like St. Paul, Minnesota, if you went to the supermarket, if you went to the gym, anywhere you went, you were likely to run into somebody who recognized you. And you always had to remember that you were the public face of the institution. You always had to remember, as someone said to me once, that even when you're in your office, everything you say through a megaphone. And so I wasn't struggling so much with adjusting to the breadth of the responsibilities. For someone like me who's not naturally extroverted, I had to struggle a little bit with the 24/7 public nature of the role.
Right. Well, let's talk about your book, because it is very, very interesting on many levels. And I thought what we'd do is maybe begin with your broad thesis and then just kind of narrow down into some of the particulars. But I want to read a couple sentences and then just have you go to town, as it were. You say, "For years, I have pondered the question of why an industry so widely populated by people who consider themselves politically liberal is so deeply conservative when it comes to its own work. Why scholars whose disciplines are constantly evolving are so resistant to institutional evolution. Why colleges and universities that almost always speak in their mission statements about the transformative power of education find it so difficult to transform themselves. Why virtually no fundamental practice within higher education, calendar, tenure process, pedagogy, grading, has changed in meaningful ways for decades, if not centuries." And then you go on to say, "If maintenance of the status quo is the goal, higher education has managed to create the ideal system." So talk about that broadly, and also maybe how this kind of this understanding came to you. I mean, when you were at McAllister for 17 years, you know, are you so deeply into the trenches? It's only when you were able to, you know, when you left in 2020 and, you know, spent time at Harvard, that you were able to get this kind of bigger picture sense of just the resistance of the overall system to change.
Yeah, so let me begin with the notion that higher education is in fact a deeply conservative industry. I think it's hard to argue with the claim that of all major industries in this country, higher education has probably changed the least over the last century. I think it was Jonathan Zimmerman at the University of Pennsylvania who's very smart about these things, who said that if Henry Adams walked into a classroom today, he would find it very familiar. And the truth is that while we've replaced overhead projectors and a lot of blackboards have become whiteboards, and there are all kinds of ways in which technology affects teaching, the fundamental delivery system, the fundamental model of higher education has changed not nearly as much as the model in almost any other industry. And you know, there could be two reasons for that. One is we just have it right, and there's no need to change. And the other is that there's something fundamental that is preventing more transformational changes. And I'm inclined to believe the second. And I'm also inclined to believe that it's not because people in higher education don't want to do a good job. I think the vast majority of faculty and administrators and staff I've encountered are deeply committed to the work and want to do a good job. And so what I tend to look for are structural and cultural reasons that prevent more than incremental change. And that's what led me to to write the book and to think about the things that I write about in the book. Was I aware of these things when I was at McAllister? You know, I was increasingly aware of them as I moved throughout my career. But where you are positioned in the system has a great deal to do with how you see it. And certainly as a college president, your number one responsibility is to do no harm to your institution and to advance its interests. And, you know, to quote something that I say at the beginning of the book, a quote that I borrowed from someone at the African Leadership University, it's hard to read the label when you're inside the bottle. When you're inside a system, for as long as I was, it's really hard to pull back and take a look relatively objectively at its strengths and weaknesses. And so stepping outside the bottle, at least partially, in moving into my current role, and in particular in working outside of an American context at a startup university in a situation of great constraint, I think brought into clearer focus some of the things that were limiting the ability of higher education in developed countries to change in more than very small ways.
Well, let's talk for a second about the role of a college president. I mean, it's that sort of a sub theme that permeates your book. And you describe it at one point as a nearly undoable job. You know, Admiral McRaven famously said it was the toughest job in America. And as you point out in the book, I mean, you liken it at times to mayors of cities in which they have so many different constituencies, lots of demands for results, lots of constraints on your power. So why is the job of a college or university president so daunting, even to people like McRaven, who's, you know, had, you know, lots of complex operational challenges in the military?
Yeah, when someone who's led U.S. Special Forces says that being a president is harder, it does catch your attention. Look, I would never make the claim that being a college president is the hardest job in the U.S. There are lots and lots of people who do lots and lots of jobs that are harder and less well compensated. So I just want to make that clear at the beginning. But it is increasingly a very, very difficult and in many ways an undoable job. And there are lots of reasons for that. But, you know, at root, I think it's because college presidents are expected to satisfy a wide range of constituencies whose interests and priorities are not aligned with one another. And so virtually everything you do will make some influential group unhappy. And sometimes you will make them unhappy by doing nothing. And so, you know, you have faculty, tenured, untenured, full-time, part-time. If you're at a university, you have graduate students, you have undergraduate students, you have alumni, you have parents, you have donors, you have trustees, you have politicians increasingly, you have people in the community around the institution. They all expect different things from a college or university, and often they don't agree within each constituency about what they want. And so when you have an organization where there's not a lot of alignment around mission and purpose, it's very hard to be a leader. And when you layer on top of that, that most of the power of a college president is what I would call soft power, not hard power. You're not like the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. You can't simply lock yourself in a room with a leadership team, decide you're going to change direction, go out and make an announcement. Most of your power comes through setting an example, through inspiring, through persuasion, through political skill. As Jim Collins wrote in his book on nonprofits, you have to convince people to get on the bus with you. You can't force them to get on the bus. And so when you add all those factors together, layer on top of that, the effect of social media, which, you know, I was very lucky. I started my college presidency in 2003. There was no Facebook, there was no Twitter. I think it gave me space to make some hard decisions and to make some mistakes without 10,000 people telling me that I should resign. College presidents today don't have that luxury. And as we all know, we also live in an extraordinarily fractious and polarized moment. And inevitably, colleges are going to be caught up in that. So you add this entire mix together, And it becomes very, very difficult to do that job in a way that satisfies all the people that you need to satisfy.
Well, Brian, I underlined about half your book, but I'm going to read one passage that I underlined and it actually read out loud to my wife. It says, "There was no incentive whatsoever for me to attempt to be disruptive or transformational because the odds of success were so low and the price of trying was so high. Regardless of the fact that nearly every presidential job description and nearly every presidential search committee speaks to the desire for a change agent, the truth is that an actual change agent is something that only the most desperate college communities want, and even the most desperate ones are not sure about." Talk about that, just the sheer difficulty of, you know, transforming a university, transforming an institution when everyone says rhetorically they want it.
Yeah. So first of all, I think most institutions have it backward. So I think it is true that if you look at job ads for new presidents, they do talk about things like transformation, change, innovation. The president who's in the worst position to enact transformational change is a new president. A new president hasn't had any time to build up any political capital, hasn't had time to learn the particular culture of the institution, hasn't had time to build trust. And so typically what happens is if a new president comes in and tries to change things too dramatically, there's an enormous amount of pushback. And I've spoken to a lot of new college presidents who have faced exactly that. They're given a charge by the Board of Trustees to change things. They try to change things. Often the board suddenly vanishes and they're left to face votes of no confidence and anger from students and alumni. I actually think the presidents in the best position to push for more dramatic change are presidents who have been in their roles for some time and have built up both political capital and trust, know their institutions, and frankly have less to lose if people are unhappy. So I think we are putting too much on the shoulders of new presidents. And again, we have to recognize that a president's power to enact the changes, the even necessary changes for an institution, is severely limited. I think generally people dramatically overstate the power of a college president. When you have a tenured faculty and you're a college president on a limited contract, you actually are much more vulnerable than most members of your faculty. You may have all the good ideas in the world, but working through systems of shared governance and against interests which often are not incentivized to change makes it very hard, even when change is almost essential.
Well, another passage I loved, you said, the easiest way to survive for an extended time in a presidency is to stay in your lane, raise money, give speeches, show up at sporting events, and balance the budget, but do not try to interfere with the actual core academic work of the institution. There be dragons.
So yeah, I've studied the history of shared governance a lot, particularly in writing this book. And if you look at the original AAUP statement on shared governance, which goes back to 1966, it is very explicit about the fact that the faculty has responsibility for the academic program of the institution. But at the same time, it says that the president is responsible for innovating, which seems to me a tension, maybe even a contradiction that's built into the document from the beginning. If one grants that the most important aspect of a college or university is the academic program, one grants that the responsibility for that program lies with the faculty, but that the responsibility for innovation lies with the president, you have a built-in tension. And I think most college presidents feel that tension pretty acutely. They know that the most important decisions about any college or university affect or are related to the academic program. And that is the area of the institution over which they have the least control. As president, I was able to make many decisions about the budget. I could make decisions about administrative staffing. I could make decisions about student affairs. I could make decisions about capital campaigns. But at McAllister, at least, with our system of governance, it required a vote of the full faculty to eliminate an academic program. So I essentially had no control other than using a bully pulpit over that. And so that sort of disjunction is very common within academia. So college presidents are in a situation where the most important area of their institution is the one over which they have the least control. And when you stray into that area, just take a look at the presidents who have run into votes of no confidence. It's almost always because they tried to exercise too much control over areas that the faculty felt were within their purview.
Well, let's talk about one of the institutions that you think should be rethought, and that is the college lecture, which you trace back roughly 1,000 years. I think to 1050 is a date you offer. And you alluded to this earlier. I mean, you make note of the fact that this has been kind of a pillar of university teaching literally for centuries. And yet there's fairly compelling research that shows that this is just not the best way for students to learn, absorb information, be engaged. Talk about just the utter resilience of the university lecture. Is it just because its simplicity is kind of unmatched, or why is it so resilient? And do you think that there are some significant changes occurring to that, that is the kind of the centerpiece of education?
You know, look, if you go back to the origin of the modern university, which really does go back more than a millennium, to Europe. Universities, when they were formed, were places that you had to go to access knowledge. They were places that you had to go to where they had libraries and where they had experts. And the job of those experts was, in effect, to pour the knowledge into the head of the students, to fill your head with knowledge. And that model of the university being a place where you go to read and listen to smart people has essentially persisted for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it continues to persist today. And I would never argue that there's no place in a university context for a lecture. What I would argue is that we dramatically over-rely on a form of instruction that has been shown to be less than optimally effective. There's a lot of evidence, as you say, to show that people learn more effectively by doing than listening. How many of us who sat in college classrooms and listened to lectures, even entertaining lectures, 10 years later, retain what was in that lecture? The things we tend to retain are the things that we learn by doing them. And so there have been a lot of very smart people, including a physicist at Harvard named Eric Mazur, who've done a lot of work that demonstrates that students in science classes, for instance, learn more and retain the knowledge better if they are engaged in active learning, in doing things, rather than sitting passively in a classroom. And there are some faculty and some institutions that are embracing this concept. But by and large, we've still stuck with the lecture as the primary mode of delivery. I think it has a lot to do with the role of culture and tradition. Most of us who were college professors came up through a system where we listened to lectures. We had very little instruction as graduate students in how to teach. So the only way we learned how to teach was by observing our own teachers. And what we tend to do is replicate what we observed. And on some level, we think, well, it worked for us, so it must work for my students. And so in the absence of any real evidence that the lecture is effective, we tend to rely on habit, tradition, personal circumstance. There's been some good research done at Carnegie Mellon, for instance, which is one of the most technologically sophisticated universities in the world, that there's still faculty resistance to taking up new technologies, and it has much more to do with culture than with evidence of effectiveness. So again, it's one of those aspects of university life, I think, that is shaped by longstanding cultures and habits more than by a lot of attention to the evidence.
Well, another aspect of that that you write about very powerfully is just the silos that are just endemic in universities and colleges. And you said that no, very few other industries are kind of chopped into such so many pieces. And you discussed McAllister, which has a school of less than 2,000 students, I think, and it has 32 departments, 38 majors, 39 minors. Larger schools have that times many, many more. And then you also make the point that these divisions, I mean, affect the culture. That if you're a political science professor at McAllister, you sort of think of yourself as a political science professor first, and a professor at McAllister second or third. So talk about the silos that are so endemic in the academic world.
Yeah, again, people who study institutional change and institutional effectiveness will almost always come to the conclusion that organizations that are highly siloed, where people don't talk to one another across boundaries, where there's not a lot of shared agreement about mission and purpose, are less effective than ones where people talk across those boundaries. And higher education is, as you say, one of the most siloed and fragmented enterprises that exist. Even smaller institutions than McAllister, institutions with 800 or 1,000 students, will often offer 30 or 40 different majors. Essentially, even small colleges try to replicate, for the most part, the large university model, which is a little bit of everything for everybody. And it makes it very, very difficult to do any of those things particularly well when you're trying to do lots of things when you don't have the resources. And it's also true that academics are trained and acculturated to think of themselves essentially as members of a disciplinary guild. When I went through my PhD program at McAllister in English, not once in the 4+ years that I went through that program, was I encouraged to think of myself as part of a larger intellectual community. Not once was I asked to think about what it meant to be part of a college. All of the focus was on studying English, preparing to be an English professor. And so, of course, you come out, if you're a graduate student, thinking of yourself as an English professor or as a biology professor or as an economics professor. And then you move into an English department or a biology department or an economics department. And that's where your primary intellectual allegiance lies, not to a larger multidisciplinary institution with lots of different parts. And when people can't agree on a common mission and purpose, it makes it extraordinarily difficult to push for change. In order for there to be change, you have to agree on the need for it and the direction it needs to move in. And with so many different parts that are so dissociated from one another, it's very, very difficult for that to happen. I use the analogy in the book of a college faculty being more like an all-star team than like a baseball team. If you're a member of the Red Sox, presumably, you think of yourself as a member of a team and you define success in terms of the team. If you're a second baseman on an all-star team, you think of yourself as a representative of second baseman par excellence and have much less allegiance to a particular team. And I think most college faculties think of themselves more in terms of being all-star teams than being teams.
Well, let's talk about the academic calendar. And here you are really interesting. You make note that there is this kind of mythology that these long summer breaks, harken back to our agrarian past when, students went home and worked on in the farm and so forth. But you say the truth is that these summer breaks have much more to do with, kind of pre-air conditioning. But just also mentioned that, in a university college now, there's instruction for about 30 weeks of the year. So 22 weeks, the campus is largely empty. But you make the further argument that, maybe looking at all this, we should compress the academic undergraduate program into 3 years, much more efficient use of the students' time, much more, you know, cost effective for the students. So talk about the academic calendar and why that should be changed, why that's an important part of changing the college experience.
Yeah, the calendar may be the clearest example of something that exists in academia simply because it's always existed. You know, there are many, many reasons to think about reducing the time to completion of a degree. First of all, the easiest way to reduce the cost of a degree is to reduce it from 4 years to 3 years. And in many parts of the world, an undergraduate degree is 3 years. You know, at the African Leadership University, students still take 120 credits, but they essentially have 15 weeks on, 3 weeks off, 15 weeks on, 3 weeks off, 15 weeks on, 3 weeks off, and they finish it in 3 years. And the same is true in a number of countries in Europe and in other parts of the world. And so it would reduce the cost. There's also evidence that during those long summer breaks, there's learning loss, particularly for the least affluent students, the students who don't have the ability over the summer to go to musical camps or get personal tutors, but who have to work. So there's no evidence at all that students learn better because they have these long breaks. The strongest arguments in favor of the current calendar have to do with the ability of faculty to do research. And that opens up a whole other area of discussion, which is how we should think about the relation between those two enterprises. I will acknowledge that some colleges have tried the three-year degree. It hasn't caught on. Four-year college is very much thought of as a kind of rite of passage in the United States, even though a surprisingly low number of students actually graduate in 4 years. But the fact that we don't have more variety in college calendars, that at least there isn't a substantial number of institutions that have gone to a three-year calendar, speaks to the role of stasis and emulation in higher education. And I have to believe as the cost issue becomes more and more prominent, that you're going to see more momentum around three-year colleges. Most people who are thinking about starting new institutions right now that I've spoken to are thinking about getting students through in 3 years rather than four. So it's, you know, these physical plants are extraordinarily expensive to run and maintain. And the fact that they, at many institutions, either sit empty or are used for, you know, McAllister cheerleading camps or arts programs for kids in K through 12 school. There's nothing wrong with those things, but that's a lot of money being spent on areas that are not related to the core academic mission of the institution. It's just an extraordinary inefficiency built into the system right now.
Well, one of the other sacred cows you take on pretty frontally is this link between scholarship and teaching excellence. And you tell the story early in the book of a desire to just even have a debate at McAllister about, you know, whether, you know, high-powered scholarship actually, you know, lends itself to teaching excellence. And just even introducing the debate earned you a fairly fierce rebuke. So talk about just the resistance to discuss this issue. And also, I mean, I guess the larger issue of just the linkage, if there is one, between scholarly excellence and teaching excellence.
Yeah, another of the ironies that I found within higher education, and there's obviously a lot of discussion right now about the importance of academic freedom, and I believe in that, and the importance of allowing even controversial ideas to be voiced on a campus. The irony is that there are certain ideas about academia itself that are almost impossible to voice without getting enormous pushback. And one of those is about the assumed linkage between excellence in teaching and excellence in research. If you read the faculty handbooks of lots of colleges and universities, including McAllister's, they speak to the linkage between those two things. The reality is the research does not support that. There's been research done over a couple of decades now, including very recently, that indicates that there is no particular correlation, positive or negative, between traditional measures of research productivity and teaching effectiveness. So it's not to say that research hurts teaching, but it's also not to say that the best researchers are also the best teachers. And so the fact, A, that you can't even talk about it, as you said, when I tried to bring it up at McAllister simply as a subject for discussion, it was enormous pushback. How many college presidents or deans do you hear raising that issue? They just don't, even though they've seen the same evidence that I've seen. So I think that's a problem. But the larger question is, why do we make the assumption in American higher education that important research and essential teaching necessarily have to take place in the same institutions? It's a model that was borrowed from Germany in the middle of the 19th century and has stuck around. And even at undergraduate teaching institutions, there's been over the last several decades an increasing emphasis on faculty members doing research without any evidence that it necessarily benefits students. Teaching loads have generally at more well-resourced institutions gone down. Even the fact that we use the phrase teaching load suggests somehow that teaching is a burden when we talk about research opportunities. It's an amazing thing about higher education that the core activity, teaching students, is seen as something that one wants to do as little of as possible. The one exception to this are faculty who teach at community colleges, who do the most teaching, have the lowest level of research expectations, and are the least well compensated and the least highly regarded. To me, there's something backwards about the fact that in American higher education, the most acclaimed and highly compensated faculty members are ones who do the least teaching, and the least acclaimed and the least highly compensated are the ones who do the most teaching. It's called higher education. And to me, there is something profoundly upside down about that. It's a very, very hard thing to talk about.
Well, Brian, you mentioned earlier the notion of collective governance, and you made some references to that. I want to read a sentence or two that you gave and then just broaden the discussion. You say, shared governance is one of those things that if you ask any college president off the record, they'll probably express their frustrations. Then they'll go back to campus and wax poetic about the wonders of shared governance because it's what they have to do to survive. Talk about, you know, that, and also maybe in the context of strategic planning, because I loved your section on strategic planning, and I just want to read one sentence and then you can answer more broadly. You're talking about the pattern for strategic planning at colleges and universities, and you write, new president, new strategic plan, fundraising campaign to support the plan, departure of president, rinse, wash, repeat.
Yeah, so this is one of the numerous third rails that exist in higher education. Shared governance is a system that is designed for slow incremental change and to prevent dramatic change. And if you're in an industry where slow incremental change is what is desired, it could be a pretty effective system. Because you're not going to change anything rapidly or dramatically in a system of shared governance. Because shared governance relies on consensus among a variety of groups and lots of people. And generally, consensus is at least in tension with dramatic innovation, because most people don't like dramatic change. And you could argue that for much of its history, slow incremental change has served higher education really well. Most of the oldest institutions in the world are colleges and universities. And so they've stuck around in part because they haven't changed dramatically with every external change in the world around them. But if you believe that the current moment requires more than slow incremental change from higher education, that we're at a different moment, then a system of shared governance is not a very effective way to deal with that. Anytime you're trying to build consensus among a large, diverse group of people with different interests and different priorities, it is very, very hard to move quickly. And Right now, I think a lot of higher education institutions are in a situation where they need to move quickly if they're going to survive. And shared governance makes that very, very difficult. So, my own view is that colleges need to find a way. Not, you don't want a presidential dictatorship. That is at least as bad as and probably worse than anything you find in shared governance. But what you do want to do is find a way for smaller groups of people, faculty, staff, administrators, to develop and test innovative ideas without having been them be shut down by a majority that simply doesn't want change. So just look at most college strategic plans. There's very little strategic in them. You could take 10 different college strategic plans from 10 different colleges, shuffle them up, and I would dare you to identify which plan came from which college, because they're all going to look pretty much the same, and they will all have taken 2 or 3 years to produce and have had input from hundreds of different people. And what you end up doing is filtering out any distinctive ideas, and you end up with something that is the least objectionable to the largest number of people.
I think in your book, you quote someone who said, oh, we had this amazing strategic planning process. We had, 1,400 stakeholders but made no real reference to the specifics or substance of the strategic change that the plan suggested.
Yeah, the success of college strategic plans, and if you look at the way colleges talk about them, is often associated with the number of people who participated in the process. We had this many meetings with this many stakeholders and had this many suggestions. That's all well and good, but that says nothing about the ultimate effectiveness of the product. Strategic plans should not be measured by how many people went into forming them. They should be measured by the effectiveness of the strategy they contain.
As I was reading your book, I was thinking of a quip I heard from an Israeli diplomat. I mean, he wrote it down, in which he was talking about consensus. He says, everyone agrees to say collectively what no one believes individually. Just the notion of on the one hand, at universities, of course, you want to get the broadest input possible. But by doing that, oftentimes when you come forward with statements and policies, it's become so diluted that it's almost a cliche.
Yeah, it's, again, you have multiple diverse constituencies that don't necessarily have the same perspective as one another. And if your goal is to produce something that is at least acceptable to all of those constituencies, what are the odds that there's going to be anything in there that is truly innovative? An innovative strategic plan should have at least something in it that makes somebody mad, because it means you're doing something different. It means that you are challenging accepted wisdom. It means that you are pushing back against the sacred cow. You're doing something that's disruptive, something that's innovative. And college strategic plans typically try to avoid that. They want everybody, you're never going to make everybody happy, but they want everybody to be as unangry as possible when the plan is finalized.
Brad, let's talk about tenure. You take that on pretty frontally and you say, to an even greater extent than shared governance, tenure is expressly designed to prevent change. So let's talk about the broader implications of tenure, and also just how peculiar it is. As you write, the sort of model is that people work furiously for the first 6 or 7 years, get tenure, and then for the next 30 or 40 years, their work focus might be different. I mean, as you point out, most people take their work seriously and continue to work, but the system is strange where, the expectations are so high on the front end and so low going forward.
Yeah. And as I say this in the book, I acknowledge it was the hardest chapter for me to write, because first of all, I myself was a tenured faculty member for, well, I was a tenured track faculty member for 15 years. I had tenure for the last 9 of those years. I had tenure when I was a dean, not when I was a president. I don't believe college presidents should have tenure. I think not in the majority among college presidents in that belief. But there are many things about tenure that I've long defended. And I also do not want to align myself with some of the attacks on tenure that we're seeing right now politically, because I think that having legislatures make decisions about things like curriculum and hiring would be far worse than any of the weaknesses of tenure. The one thing that I think it's impossible to argue about tenure is that it makes change easier. Tenure, again, like shared governance, is designed more to preserve than to change, both on the individual level and on the institutional level. So on the individual level, if you hire someone like me to teach Victorian literature in 1985, you're still going to have somebody teaching Victorian literature unless that person chooses to leave or something happens 30 years later, whether there's the same level of need, student interest, or resources as there was when that person was hired. And so it preserves individual positions, and it makes it very, very difficult to change a curriculum in anything more than an incremental way, because you can't take a tenured French professor and say, you know, we need you over in computer science. It doesn't work that way. So it is a very effective way of preserving the status quo. The two original justifications for tenure, and this goes back again to the AAUP and the 1940 statement on tenure and academic freedom, were, first of all, economic security. Academics are not paid as well, or at least in 1940, were not paid as well as people in many other professions. And so in order to attract the best minds, rather than offering them high salaries, you offer them job security. The second argument was academic freedom, that in order to protect the ability of faculty members to speak their minds, to teach what they wanted, to research what they wanted, they needed the protection of tenure. Both of those arguments, I think, have become attenuated in recent years. First of all, as I try to show in the book, tenured faculty members who are, after all, in a nonprofit service profession, are in fact not compensated at a much lower level than people who go into nursing or public defenders or other service professions. Again, the least well compensated are at community colleges, but at an R1 university, a full professor is compensated at a pretty reasonable level and generally has pretty good benefits. And as recent political developments have shown, tenure is not necessarily protection against infringements on academic freedom. The fact that faculty in Florida are tenured has not stopped the legislature from saying there are certain things you can't teach. You know, my own view is that academic freedom is essential. It should extend to every faculty member and every member of an academic staff on a campus, whether they're tenured or not. And that by tying it to tenure, in some ways, we've made it seem like those who are not tenured don't have the same right to academic freedom as those who are. So it's clearly one of the things that has contributed to the public loss of confidence in higher education. It's really, really hard to justify these days to people who are not in academia why a professor at Harvard should have a guarantee of lifetime employment when nobody else in our society other than federal judges has the same guarantee. Anytime a benefit is only defended by those who have it, you need to take a careful look at that benefit and see whether it's justified. I don't think it's going away anytime soon, but we know that it is gradually eroding. And again, one of the unfortunate effects is that because so many resources are devoted to tenure, institutions are having to hire poorly compensated, part-time, non-tenure track faculty. And the result is a kind of two-tiered system where there's one group, which is now only 30 to 35% of faculty nationwide that have this incredible privilege. And there's a much larger group that does not. And I think in many ways is suffering as a result of the privilege that that other group has.
Well, let's kind of pull all this together because, you know, the notion of crisis in higher education is, you know, been said for many, many decades and has become something of a cliche. But you make a pretty compelling case that this time it's different. There are some really, really tough demographics coming down the pike. Perhaps more troubling is the fact that a growing percentage of high school students are choosing not to go to college. I was stunned to learn that, like, in Arizona, about half did not go to college. You know, the costs are skyrocketing, pressure, you know, from the public is growing, pressure from the political class is really, you know, exploding. So it does seem like there is a crisis moment, and this time is different. I mean, tell me you also sketch out in your book several different paths to reform. You talk about two schools in Vermont, Sterling and Middlebury, and how one is maybe more of a model for change. But go big picture with us and tell us about whether this current system can endure.
Yeah, I would completely understand if people listen to what I say and say, well, it's the boy crying wolf again. We've heard this about higher education essentially since the beginning of higher education in the United States, and I get it. But the reality is that every once in a while there is a wolf. And I've become convinced, certainly in my career, that there's never been a moment like this for higher education. There's never been a moment this challenging. And you mentioned some of the factors. The cost is becoming simply unsustainable for the vast majority of people. The increase in the cost of a higher education has coincided with growing income inequality and a shrinking of the middle class. And so there's a smaller and smaller group of people who are willing and able to pay the cost of a higher education. And that's why the discount rate is going up very rapidly. The US is an aging population. And we are headed for what is called a demographic cliff. Over the next several years, we're going to see a 15% drop in the number of traditionally aged high school graduates in the U.S. It's going to hit most heavily in the Northeast and the Midwest, where a lot of these institutions are located. You mentioned the loss in public confidence. We're seeing historically low levels of public confidence in higher education. And then maybe at the end of the day, the most consequential thing will be technology. You know, Clayton Christensen was talking a couple of decades ago about the fact that higher education, traditional higher education, will be disrupted. I've pushed back hard repeatedly against a lot of his claims, but I've come to believe that he was not so much wrong as premature. You know, and, you know, what he said at the time was that industries that had what he called a technological core, that were disruptable by technology, would in fact be disrupted. And we've seen that in industry and after industry across the United States and across the world. For a long time, higher education was really not disruptable by technology. You still, same model, faculty member, students, classroom. Technology wasn't going to change that. Well, when you look at what technology is doing now, and you look in particular at artificial intelligence on top of everything else, the odds that technology is not going to dramatically disrupt higher education over the next 10 years are very small. So when you put all of this together, I think you find a situation that is more perilous for traditional higher education than it has been certainly in my lifetime. You know, one response to that can be to simply deny that it all exists and keep doing what you're doing. And another response can be to try to come up with some innovations that address some of these challenges. And most of the innovation that I'm seeing right now is not happening in traditional legacy institutions. It's happening outside the United States. It's happening in institutions that are trying to start up, it's trying in a handful of institutions that have really radically transformed themselves into something different. But I'm hoping to see more traditional legacy institutions try to do some different things to be relevant and effective in the current moment. Just to give one quick example, if 18 to 22-year-olds are going to be less numerous, then you're going to have to think about doing more to educate what we've always called non-traditional students. You know, the one way to grow your audience is to go after a different group of people, many of whom really want more education. But in order to do that, you can't expect them to live in a dormitory and show up for 9 o'clock classes 3 days a week. You're going to have to use other methods, including technology, to reach those people.
Well, Brian, talk about you've made references to your work with the African Leadership University. It seems like, as you say, they operate, it was effectively a startup operating in an environment of real constraint, but is doing some really innovative work, including I was really struck by the concept of not embracing the notion of majors, but structuring learning around missions. So talk about your work with them.
So the African Leadership University was found. The reason I got involved was it was founded by Fred Swanaker, who graduated from McAllister before I arrived, but I got to know him. And it's designed to be part of an effort to address one of the world's most pressing problems. Africa is the youngest continent in the world. The median age is 19. In the US, it's 38. It has the most rapidly growing population, and it is the most underserved by higher education. Only 9% of students who graduate from high school in Africa go on to some form of post-secondary education. And the average middle-class family in Africa, and that is a small minority, can afford to pay about $2,000 or $3,000 a year for a university. So the Western model, the American model, the European model simply will not work at any kind of scale in an African context. And so ALU was designed to answer the question, what can we deliver at scale in a continent that desperately needs it, that will be both effective and affordable? And so what it's meant is rethinking from the ground up the whole educational model. You can't rely as heavily on faculty with PhDs. There aren't enough of them in Africa. You can't rely as heavily on a physical infrastructure. It's too expensive. You have to rely more heavily on students as the directors of their own learning journey. You know, this goes back to John Dewey. It's not a new concept. You have to rely more heavily on technology. So, you know, we could spend a whole hour talking about the things that ALU has done, but the reality right now is that ALU is educating about 2,500 students with a tuition price of $3,000. And the early results in terms of student learning are very, very good. So it's hard work and there's a lot still to be learned. But when you start with a green field, when you start from scratch and you say, what would we build today? If we were building a university today, how many of the things that we're doing would we still do? I think if everyone asked themselves that question, I think we would come up with institutions that were much more varied and looked very different from a lot of the institutions we have now in the United States. So, you know, this is an area where experimentation is possible. And so it's one of the reasons it's been so interesting and so rewarding for me to engage in that work. Pulling outside of the American bubble and seeing higher education from a different perspective has been illuminating to me. It's hard, but you know, at the entryway to both ALU campuses is a three-word phrase: do hard things. And so the fact that it's hard to change higher education doesn't mean we shouldn't try to do it.
Brian, finally, let's tell us a little bit about your life now in terms of, I know you're working hard with ALU. You're at Harvard Graduate School of Education as a scholar in residence. You sit on some boards. I mean, tell us a little bit about what you're hoping to do over in this next period of your life. I mean, do you want to kind of big picture reform as well as, focusing on institutions like the African Leadership Institute?
You know, I told myself two things when I stepped down from a college presidency. One is I didn't want to manage people anymore because I found that to be the most challenging aspect of the job. And the other was I wanted to try to have an impact, and particularly an impact in education, because that's where I've spent my whole life. And so I've just been very fortunate. You know, the work I do at ALU feels extraordinarily impactful. And I've been able to get back into the classroom at the Graduate School of Education here, and to teach the next generation of people who will be college and university leaders, many of whom are interested in systemic change. So those two forms of work feel to me like they have the potential to have an impact. And it's also why I wrote the book, not because I think I have all the answers, but because I think these are topics that simply need to be discussed honestly. And if there's one thing I tried to be in the book, it was honest.
Well, let me ask you, do you have a little bit more time to read Victorian literature and Charles Dickens?
I do have the time, but I confess, these days I'm more likely to, you know, watch True Detective or read a mystery novel than reread Dickens. I did have an opportunity to do a book club about David Copperfield a few months ago, and that was fun. The reading that I do now in my own time tends to be a little lighter than what I did when I was a professor.
Well, I have to ask, throughout the book at various times, you're talking about sort of the economics of higher education. You say, well, as an English professor, let me break it down this way. And you use that in kind of a self-deprecating, but also a little bit of a device to say, okay, let's break this down into real language. I mean, talk about how being an English professor helped you during your administrative life.
Yeah, so I mean, the reason I say that is because I think some of the economic indicators are straightforward enough so that you don't have to be an economist to understand them. So that's why I talk about that. I actually found being an English professor to be extraordinarily helpful, and in particular, reading people like Dickens. You know, Dickens was someone with a deep distrust of institutions. He felt that they dehumanized people. And so I really tried in my time as a dean and as a president to never lose sight of the fact that I was also a human being, and never to let rules stand in the way of doing the right thing. Sometimes when I was a president, it drove people crazy, because if I decided that a rule was doing the wrong thing, I would say, no, I'm going to break that rule for this person. And institutions like consistency, and I get that. I found that lifetime of reading people like that really helped me hold on to some core values. I think people at McAllister probably got tired of me quoting Keats and Dickens and people like that all the time. But the reality is, I think that they got a lot of things right about human beings. And it was important for me to hold on to those things, even when I was dealing with admissions numbers and budget spreadsheets and all the rules that exist at colleges.
Great. Well, Brian, thank you for such a terrific conversation. It's been really interesting. And I have to say to the audience, whatever it is, I'm against it. Resistance to Change in Higher Education is an amazing book. I read it, underlined most of it, read it out loud to my wife to the point that I was chasing her around the house reading it. So it is an amazing book. And particularly for people who live and work and think about higher education, to me, it raises almost all of the important questions that we need to be grappling with. So I know I'm going to continue to follow. I know Brian writes some for the Chronicle of Higher Education and other publications. So I'm going to continue to follow his work. So Brian, thank you so much. It's been really fun.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to SimonCast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. SimonCast is produced in collaboration with WSIU Public Radio. You can find SimonCast wherever you listen to podcasts, including NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and more. Please subscribe to new episodes as soon as they're posted and tell your friends about our show. For more information, visit paulsimoninstitute.org. Thank you for listening, and thank you for keeping the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well.